Today is December 6th, 2014. Okay, we'll begin with three times homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good morning, everybody. Okay, so the last time we started sutta number 122 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Mahasunyata Sutta, which Venerable Nyanamoli translated this as the Greater Discourse on Voidness. But again, as I mentioned, he was translating in the 1950s. And now, for sunyata, the word emptiness has pretty much superseded the word voidness. So let's call it the Greater or Larger Discourse on Emptiness. And last time we did the first half of the sutta, in which the Buddha begins by admonishing the monks on the importance of holding aloof from, let's say, gregariousness, from associating too intimately and too often with each other. And instead, he says that the monk shines by he says that the monk does not shine by delighting in company, by taking delight in company, by devoting himself to company. And then he says it's not possible that a monk who delights in company and so on will ever obtain easily the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. And it's to be expected that when a monk lives alone, withdrawn from society, he will obtain the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. And from the next passage, it appears that what the Buddha means by this is he speaks about a distinction between two types of liberation of mind: the temporary liberation of mind, which is identified with the four jhanas, or meditative absorptions, and the four arupas, the four formless meditations. And then beyond that is what is called the perpetual and unshakable liberation of mind. This would be the liberation of mind that comes through the destruction of the defilements. And those are to be obtained when a monk lives alone, secluded, withdrawn, and so forth. And as I pointed out in the last class, there's a certain tension within the Buddha's way of presenting his teaching between the need, on the one hand, the Buddha established a Sangha, that's a monastic order made up of those who live together under rules and regulations. And part of the rules and regulations is for a junior monk, when newly ordained, to remain under a teacher for 5 years. to be living in community, in society, so to speak, in society, the monastic society, to be living under the guidance of a teacher together with elder monks for 5 years, so that one gets acquainted with the training, picks up the protocol of the monastic life, and learns to associate with those who are superior in knowledge and experience. And in general, the Buddha taught for all of his followers, to whether monastic or lay people, to associate with kalyana mita, with good friends. That is, with friends who are committed to the training in faith, virtuous conduct, good discipline, learning, meditation, and wisdom. And so it's just like, we could say, our own train of mind, so to speak, is a little bit like, do you know the creature, the chameleon? It's a lizard that changes the color of its skin according to its environment. So if it's hanging out in a cluster of green leaves, then it has green skin. But when the leaves change to, say, to red and brown, then the chameleon will change the color of its skin to red and brown. And so we're similar, we're like that. So the temperament of our minds change according to the company of the people that we keep. So if we hang out with people who are skeptics, who have undisciplined behavior, who scorn wholesome practices like generosity or observing precepts, practicing meditation, you know, before long, even though we think we can remain firm and steady in that company, but almost imperceptibly our minds get influenced by them and start changing. Whereas if we hang out with people who have faith, discipline, conduct, who observe the silas, practice meditation, learn the Dhamma, develop wisdom, their influence will have an impact on us and we'll move in that direction. Okay, so on the one hand, the Buddha emphasizes the importance of right association. In another sutta, I think we're going to come to in a little while, the Buddha compares it to like the training of an elephant. Like when you catch a wild elephant, well, you don't catch wild elephants, I don't think. But in ancient India, when they would catch a wild elephant, what they do in order to train it is to tie it up next to a tame elephant. And in this way, the wild elephant observes the behavior of the tame elephant and it starts to quiet down and become gentle, calm, and tame itself. You know, so we connect ourselves to good friends. You know, our minds might be wild, raging, full of passions and defilements. But when we start associating with good friends, then our minds become like a calm, gentle elephant. Okay, but in contrast, the Buddha also says that to develop the higher attainments, one has to go off into seclusion. If you're always associating with others, even with good friends, you know, one wants to talk, to socialize, and then the mind doesn't devote itself to training. Okay, so then after emphasizing the importance of going into seclusion, then the Buddha gives advice to the monks on how they should train their minds to abide in voidness or emptiness internally, externally, to enter into the imperturbable states. Those are the formless meditations, internally, externally. And as I pointed out, what's important in each of these sections is the concluding phrase of each section. Whatever happens, the Buddha says, in this way he has full awareness of that. And the word translated here, full awareness, is sampajano, which I prefer to translate now as clear comprehension. So whatever happens, even if he doesn't succeed, if he's trying to enter into the meditation on emptiness, if he succeeds, he has clear comprehension of that. If he doesn't succeed, again, he has clear comprehension. When he's trying to enter into the imperturbable states, the formless meditations, if he succeeds, he has clear comprehension of that. If he doesn't succeed, again, he has clear comprehension of that. And so when one has clear comprehension, if one isn't succeeding, then one is able to examine one's own mind or one's own conditions to find out, why am I not succeeding? Could it be something in the environment, maybe a noisy environment, disagreeable people, unsuitable climate, unsuitable food? And if he succeeds, okay, so then, I'm sorry, so he comprehends whether it's something external or it could be something internal. I'm letting my mind get carried away too much by thoughts of lust, thoughts of anger, too much sleep, too little sleep, too much outer activity, not enough breaks, you know, overexerting myself. And so by clear comprehension, either of the outer conditions or the inner state of mind, then one could find out what one can rectify in order to be able to achieve one's goals. Okay, so finally, in the passages that we came through last time, the monk is able to enter into voidness or emptiness internally, externally, internally, and externally, and also enter into the imperturbable states. So that's as far as we got last time, and this took us through paragraph or section number 10. So now we come to section number 11. Okay, so now this is going to be discussing how the monk, or we could say more generally, the practitioner, conducts himself or herself after mastering the attainment, and at times when they've emerged from the attainment. Okay, so the text says, when a monk abides thus, if his mind inclines to walking, then he walks, thinking, while I am walking in such a way, no evil or no bad, unwholesome states of mind. These will be states of covetousness or greed or lust, and no states of, I don't like grief here, displeasure, annoyance, irritation will overcome me. Okay, so this is before engaging in the action, one makes the determination And this is quite important, setting the intention. So now the monk is going to come out of the meditation, or he's probably come out of the meditation, and he's now intending to walk, maybe doing a walking meditation. And often what happens, and probably if you look back at your experience, you'll see that this is the case. When one is sitting in meditation over a long time, one might be able to subdue the unwholesome states of mind. But then when one comes out of the meditation and is going to change the postures, there's a kind of interval in which one drops the mindfulness, drops the clear comprehension, and it's a sort of like, okay, I'm free. I don't have to observe the breath or the loving kindness, the thought of loving kindness, or the kasina, or whatever other meditation object, the recollection of the Buddha, whatever. Now I could do whatever I want, I could think whatever I want. Well, one doesn't think like that, but it's sort of the attitude. And then all of those, you know, unwholesome thoughts that were put on the back burner just start coming over the mind just at that interval when one ends the period of sitting and before one starts doing, getting up and walking away. And so here, in order to prevent that from happening, one sets the intention or makes the determination that, in this case, when I get up and start walking, I won't let these unwholesome states of mind rise up and overcome me. And he does this, again, we see he has full awareness of that. He does that with clear comprehension. And so the text says that when the monk abides thus, if his mind inclines to standing, he stands. If the mind inclines to sitting, he sits. If his mind inclines to lying down, he'll lie down. And again, whatever posture he takes, he makes that determination. While I am either standing, sitting, lying down, I won't let these bad, unwholesome mental states overcome me. Okay, so here we have the text is explained in terms of what are often called the four iriyapata, is the term used in Pali. Do you have a counterpart of that in the singular language? Do you have iriyapata in Singhalese also?
Iriyau.
Yeah, so it's Singhalese term is based on the same expression. So these are called the four postures, sometimes translated as the four modes of deportment. I think this is the Chinese yi wei, is that what it is? Wei yi? Si wei yi. Okay, good. Okay, so these, the way I see it, this is dealing with, this section is dealing with activities of the body. So when engaged in activities of the body, before acting, one makes the determination, the intention, and then one acts in accordance with the intention. The next section is concerned with speech. And I guess this was particularly relevant to this situation because at the very beginning of the sutta, when the Buddha came across the monks who were all sitting around preparing their robes, they were probably engaging in a lot of idle chit-chat. Who won the ball game? How did, you know, did this guy get any hits? Did how did the pitcher do? Did he strike that guy out? Or did you hear the new song by Taylor Swift? Or did you see that new video of, what's her name? Cyrus Miley, is that the name?
Miley Cyrus.
Okay, so the Buddha comes on the scene and, what are you talking about? Okay, so now the Buddha gives the advice that when the monk is dwelling thus, if his mind inclines to talking, then he resolves such talk as is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, unbeneficial, and which does not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. That is, talk of kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, these were the types of subjects of talks that were current, the kind of idle chatter or gossip in the time of the Buddha. Well, a lot of them are still current today. Maybe we don't have kings, but instead the talk is of cabinet ministers, we call them cabinet, members of the cabinet, senators, governors, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, battles, food. Ah, did you taste this food? Do you like that? Oh, that was wonderful, out of this world. Oh, I don't like the food they prepare in this monastery. Let's go out to eat. Where do you want to go? Thai restaurant, Chinese restaurant? Oh, we've never been to an Ethiopian restaurant. Yeah, let's go get Ethiopian food. Oh, no, I don't like it, not so good. Let's go to Sri Lankan restaurant. Oh, I was in Sri Lanka for so many years, I've had so much Sri Lankan food. Let's go to... Okay, clothing, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, countries, women, heroes. Who are our heroes today?
We don't have any.
Oh, we have to have some heroes. I guess sports stars, movie stars, rock stars, like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. Who are some of the others?
9/11.
What?
9/11, firemen, they're regarded as heroes.
Firemen?
Yeah.
Oh, those are the real heroes.
Yeah.
Okay. Streets, I don't know why that should be. Wells, I mean, that's could be a practical concern. The dead. Trivialities, the origin of the world, the origin of the sea, whether things are so or are not so, such talk I shall not utter. Well, there goes 99.9% of topics of conversation. Okay, so instead he resolves such talk as deals with effacement. Do you know the word effacement? It's not a very common word. I think it means a limit, sort of removing desires. As talk as favors the mind's release and which leads to complete disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. That is talk on wanting little or having few desires, on contentment, on seclusion, on, I'm not sure I like this translation so much, aloofness from society. Because I've looked on the dictionaries or the thesaurus, And the word aloof is now, it's always acquired negative connotations, like being indifferent, cold-hearted, apathetic. But maybe we could render this not getting bound up with, let's say, non-gregariousness might be a better rendering. You know, not being always having to associate with others and get bound up with others. Arousing energy, and then virtue, virtuous behavior, concentration, wisdom, liberation, and the knowledge and vision of liberation. Such talk I shall utter. And in this way, he has full awareness of that. I have to confess that when I read this passage, I often feel guilty. Because so often I engage in the first type of talk, too seldom the second kind. Yeah.
Like when the monastics deal with lay people are always asking silly stuff. And what if you know that you're engaging in, you're aware of it in a way?
Yeah.
Does that make it better, or is that acceptable that you're aware that you're, you know, sometimes you have to, I guess, engage the lay people in nonsense? Because we ask all kinds of silly stuff. As long as you're aware of it, is that what
I think what one has to do is, I would say, use ordinary mundane conversation topics as a vehicle or a skillful means for introducing elements of Dharma. You know, so it's not, I think what's important is not so much the topic itself, but the state of mind in which one engages right. in that topic. Because one could talk about, I could talk about maybe some of the heroes in the sense of, we could say, like, remember the pop music stars of the past? Now they're still alive, but nobody hears of them. That's how impermanent fame and glory are. You know, when they're in their 20s, maybe early 30s, their songs are number one. They're booked up all year round on the concert tour. They're issuing 3 or 4 records a year. And their records are top sellers. And then within a few years, you know, maybe they've become out of the music scene. Maybe he has a delicatessen. He's running a former top rock star, he's now running a delicatessen, or he's working as a mailman delivering letters.
He realizes emptiness every time he reaches into his pocket.
Yeah, so this is how impermanent fame and glory are. Of course, he has a bank account of several million dollars. Okay, so this section is dealing with speech. And now we come to the next section, which is dealing with the development, or let's say the cultivation of thoughts. Okay, so now it's saying that when a monk abides thus, if his mind inclines to thinking, he resolves such thoughts as are, again, low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, unbeneficial, and which do not lead to disenchantment and so on, to nibbana. That is, and then here he mentions the three sort of characteristic unwholesome types of thoughts. Thoughts of sensual pleasure, thoughts of ill will or resentment or hatred, and thoughts of cruelty. It's thoughts of harming others. Such thoughts I shall not think. And again, he makes that resolve with clear comprehension. And then such thoughts that are noble and emancipating, and that lead the one who practices in accordance with them to the complete destruction of suffering. Those thoughts I will think, and these are the three types of wholesome thoughts: thoughts of renunciation, that is, the giving up of desire or the giving up of worldly pleasures, thoughts of non-ill will, which is often rendered or glossed as thoughts of loving kindness, and thoughts of non-cruelty or non-harming, which is often glossed as thoughts of compassion. Such thoughts I shall think. And again, this is pretty hard. You know, the mind gets overrun naturally, gets overrun by thoughts, at least of sensual pleasure and ill will. Maybe for few of us, we think of thoughts of injuring others. But sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, those sort of, even though we make the determination not to think them, but they come up spontaneously and naturally. And so as, say, relatively elementary practitioners, we have to know how to deal with these types of thoughts. And for dealing with these unwholesome thoughts, we have a number of suttas that give guidance, particularly in the early part of the Majjhima Nikaya. Sutta number 19 and Sutta number 20. So I won't explain the methods of dealing with the unwholesome thoughts today, because to get detailed explanations, you can refer back through YouTube, the videos on YouTube, to my lectures on those suttas, and they're also on the website, Yu Rong's website, called Noble Path Fellowship. You can see them there. We have, I think, a couple of classes on each of those suttas. Okay, so these sections, 11, 12, and 13, deal with how the monk who is in training trains himself after coming out from those meditative attainments, or even somebody who doesn't attain them, but who's carrying on in their day-to-day activities, how they train themselves with respect to bodily action through the four postures, four modes of deportment, through speech, how to avoid wrong speech and engage in right speech, and how to avoid unwholesome thoughts. What are the unwholesome thoughts to avoid, and the wholesome thoughts to cultivate? Okay, now I'll ask, are there any questions at this point? Okay, then shall we move on to the next section? Okay, now what's interesting is that the commentary says that the next section, or actually the next two sections, are concerned with the monk examining himself to see whether he has reached the third stage of realization, that is, the stage of the non-returner. That is, one who has cut off, the non-returner has cut off the five lower fetters, that is, the fetter of wrong views about the self, the fetter of doubt, and the fetter of clinging to rules and observances. Those are the three lower fetters. And then on top of that, the fetter of sensual desire and the fetter of ill will. And I think the commentary implies that the previous sections can be understood to deal with disciples at the level of either what's called the good worldling, that is the worldling who is training in accordance with the practice, and also disciples at the first two levels of realization, the stream enterer and the once returner. The stream enterer and the once returner have cut off the first three fetters, but they still have sensual desire and ill will. So those tendencies are still there, even in the once returner. But the non-returner cuts off the five fetters, including sensual craving and ill will. And since those are the fetters that tie living beings to the sensual sphere of existence, the non-returner doesn't come back to the sensual sphere, but will take rebirth, usually in the form sphere, and achieve final liberation from that realm. Okay, and so since the non-returner has eliminated sensual desire, so one way in which the person in training can test to see whether they've reached the stage of non-returning is by examining to see whether the connection with sensually enticing objects will have any impact on the mind, cause any kind of, even a very subtle disturbance in the mind. Okay, so this is the way the text continues. So the Buddha is speaking, again, he's speaking to Ananda, so he says, Ananda, there are these five cords of sensual pleasure. Actually, I think the word cord here is a little misleading. It was used by Venerable Nyanamoli. I don't know why he used it. But I would say simply just five objects of sensual pleasure. And what are the five? They are forms, that's visible forms, sounds, odors, tastes, and tactile sensations, which are described as wished for, desired, agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Okay, then the Buddha says, here a monk should constantly review his own mind thus. Does any mental excitement concerning any base, any object among these five objects of sensual pleasure ever arise in me? Okay, if on reviewing his mind, the monk understands mental excitement concerning anything among these five objects of sensual pleasure does arise in me, then he understands that I have not abandoned desire and lust for the five objects of sensual pleasure. It doesn't mean that when the monk comes into contact with the objects of sensual pleasure, that actual desire and lust have to arise in him. Sometimes, thoughts of desire, craving, lust don't arise, but there's just a little bit of kind of excitement or an interest arises. Like I knew a monk in Sri Lanka who was a meditation teacher, and his mind was always, he always felt that his mind was so calm and so pure that he thought he had actually reached the stage of non-returning. But he noticed that when young women came to see him, he didn't have thoughts of lust or desire, but after they would leave, there would be just a little kind of residue of excitement in the mind, which would take some time to sort of settle down. And from this, he realized that he wasn't a non-returner. Okay, so this is that's the first part of the passage. But then the Buddha continues, but if on reviewing his mind the monk understands no mental excitement concerning any object among these five objects of sensual pleasure arises in me, then he understands desire and lust for the five objects of sensual pleasure have been abandoned in me. And in this way, he has full awareness of that. I'd have to say that this requires some qualification and some further explanation. I'd say it's no guarantee that when one reviews one's own mind and one doesn't find any mental excitation, therefore you can conclude I've permanently abandoned desire and lust for the five objects of sensual pleasure. And for this, there's a story. I think it comes in the Visuddhimagga. It's based on the ancient tradition that came down in Sri Lanka. There's a part, there's a mountain in the southeast of Sri Lanka called Chitalapabbata. And it's a mountain to which monks used to go for retreat, for intensive meditation. And there was one monk who went there. His name was Venerable Dhammadina. He went there and practiced over a long time. And while there, he achieved arahatship. And then he was wondering, has my teacher achieved arahatship? And he sent his mind, he developed the iddhis, the supernormal powers, and he sent his mind out and he saw that his teacher was still a worldling, even though he hadn't achieved any stage of realization, even though because he had very strong samadhi practice, and probably he had reached various stages of insight knowledge, he had thought that he was an arahat. So Dhammadina thought, let me help my teacher. So he went to visit his teacher. He bowed down and paid respects to his teacher. And then he said to his teacher, he told him that I've been practicing in seclusion and I've achieved arhatship. Then his teacher said, wonderful, wonderful, Dhammadina. Then Dhammadina said, when did you attain it? Then his teacher said, oh, I attained it in such and such a year, so many years ago. Then Dhammadina said, did you gain the supernormal powers also? The teacher said, yes. Then Dhammadina said, okay, then can you please create the form of a beautiful girl? I think in those days it would say 16 years old, but maybe now that's not legal, so let's make it so that nobody will report on me and get me arrested. Let's say 18 years old with beautiful, well, we can't say blonde hair, this is in Sri Lanka, flowing black hair. Very dressed very beautifully with rather light clothing and with a very beautiful smile and twinkly eyes, and have her come walking towards you with a flashing smile. And so the teacher did that, and suddenly Dhammadina said to the teacher, why is your face turned red? Then the teacher realized that he hadn't achieved what he thought he had achieved. And then he said, please, Dhammadina, teach me. Then Dhammadina taught him meditation, object, and then the teacher went off into his cottage and practiced. And it's always very quick and happy ending in the stories. And then I think within one sitting or on the same day, he achieved arhatship. Okay, so the point of this story is that just because when you're alone and you examine your mind and you don't find any trace of sensual desire, don't jump to the conclusion, therefore I'm a non-returner. To confirm it, one would probably have to test oneself by going out into a busy place or discuss one's practice and realization with a knowledgeable teacher. Okay, so this section, 14 and 15, are concerned with the way to test, or at least a possible way to test, the attainment of the third stage of realization, that is, the stage of non-returning. But even the non-returner still has subtle defilements remaining. And one of these defilements is called asmi-mana, which is the conceit I am based on the five aggregates. And so if when one moves from the stage of non-returner to the stage of arhatship, one does so by eradicating the conceit I am. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to explain how one uses this as a test for the attainment of arhatship. Okay, so the Buddha says, Ananda, there are these five aggregates subject to clinging. In regard to these, the monk should abide contemplating rise and fall. Thus, such as material form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness, such its arising, such its passing away. So this is the knowledge of arising and passing away in regard to the five aggregates. And the knowledge of arising and passing away is, in a nutshell, what kind of contemplation in terms of the three characteristics?
Anicca.
Right, anicca or impermanence. So this is seeing the subtle impermanence of the five aggregates, that they're constantly arising and passing away. And so when he abides contemplating rise and fall in these five aggregates subject to clinging, the conceit I am based on these five aggregates is abandoned in him. Okay, when that is so, then the monk understands the conceit I am based on these five aggregates subject to clinging is abandoned in me. And in that way, he has full awareness of that. It seems that a section is, or at least some sentences, are left out here, which should have been here. That is, that the monk examines himself, and if he sees that he still has some conceit I am based on the five aggregates, then maybe not. No, maybe this is intelligible in itself. Okay, now, there's a difference between the view of a self and the conceit I am. The view of a self is somewhat coarser. That is, it takes the form of holding some conceptual formulation that I am this, I am that, this is myself, this is my real identity. And so one formulates a distinct view of oneself, a kind of theoretical position regarding the self in relation to the five aggregates. I'm one of the five aggregates, or I'm the owner of the five aggregates, or the self is inside the five aggregates, or the self is like some great cosmic entity that contains the five aggregates, that there's some kind of substantial, permanent, essential identity, which is my true self. That is the view of a self, and that is eliminated by the first stage of realization, the stage of stream entry. But even though that view of self is eradicated, even for the non-returner, there is a subtle idea of I that hangs around the five aggregates. Even though the non-returner doesn't identify any of the five aggregates as being myself, but it just is some kind of subtle sense that there is an I here. One sutta that occurs in the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 22, number 89. It's the sutta spoken by a monk named Kaimuka. He compares this to the fragrance of a flower. So we don't say that the fragrance of the flower should be identified with the petals or the inside, what is the inner part of a flower called?
Stamen.
Well, there's the stamen and the pistils, but the holes inside it. Anybody have a flower garden? No flower lovers? Okay, we'll call the So we don't identify the fragrance with the petals, the stamen, the pistils. Pericarp? No, the pericarp is part of the heart. Or with the stamen, pistils, the leaves. So we don't identify the fragrance with any part of the flower, but yet the fragrance hangs around and emanates from the flower. And so the non-returner doesn't identify I with any one of the five aggregates, or he doesn't take any position regarding the self in relation to the five aggregates, but some sense of I hangs around the five aggregates. In the same sutta, also uses the simile of, this is the way clothes were cleaned in ancient India, and maybe they're still used today in the villages. What they do is to take, you know, they don't have the detergent or the powder like Tide or Fab that you put into the washing machine, and it comes out with a nice fragrance. So that to wash the clothes, they would use cow dung, usually a combination of cow dung, ashes, and sand, and wash. First, they wash the clothes in the river or out in a well, the water taken from a well, with the ashes and combination of ashes and cow dung. And so it gets rid of all of the dirt and grime and grease from the clothes. But then after the clothes dry, there's still a little bit of the unpleasant fragrance from the cow dung and the ashes. So then what they do is to take the clothes and put them in a casket, and they put a kind of incense at the bottom of the casket and keep the clothes in the casket for a certain time. Then when they open it and take out the clothes, then all of the fragrance or all of the smell from the cow dung and the ashes is gone, and the clothes have a nice, beautiful fragrance from the incense. And so the ashes and cow dung, this is like compared to the knowledge or the wisdom which is used to achieve the stage of non-returner. That wisdom gets rid of all of the ideas of self, all of the theories and views of self. It gets rid of sensual desire and ill will. But there's still a little bit of unpleasant fragrance hanging around the five aggregates, which comes from this conceit, I am. And so then the non-returner continues to cultivate the knowledge of, or the insight into arising and passing away. And as the disciple continues to cultivate that insight, they eliminate the conceit, I am, and with this achieve arahatship. Okay, now I'll ask whether there's any questions on anything covered so far. Wow, you have to stand up. Don't we have more chairs? Yeah, aren't there folding chairs folded in the back?
Okay.
Yeah.
The question of the five objects of sensual pleasure, instead of courts, you said you would rather do objects?
Yeah.
Now, sorry to say, I looked at the Pali.
Yeah.
It's a Kama Guna.
It's Kama Guna, yeah.
Could you explain what Guna? Because sometimes Kama Chanda, there are so many of them.
Yeah, good. I think guna in the very early text simply has the meaning of qualities. So these would be sensual qualities.
The dictionary somehow says like a strand, something like that.
You know, I don't know of the word guna being used in the sense of a strand. Maybe they're using strand in relation to kama guna, so you could say strand of sensual pleasure, which again sounds a little bit strange to me. I would say the word guna later takes on, or at least already I think in some of the later texts of the Pali Canon, but especially in the commentaries, it takes on the meaning of excellent qualities, virtuous qualities. But in the earliest text, I don't think it yet has that meaning. I think it could mean simply qualities. It has another meaning in regard to folding something. When one folds something in half, like we say twofold, this would be diguna. Folding something fourfold, this would actually, diguna, I think, is folding something fourfold. Maybe it's tatuguna. Did you have? I thought I saw a hand in the back. Okay, forward.
Why a non-returner uses the method of contemplating the impermanence to achieve arahatship instead of the method contemplating into the non-self?
Actually, that eventually I'll go into all three characteristics. But I think the arising and passing away here is mentioned just to show like the starting point of the course of insight. But they'll have to achieve insight into all three characteristics.
Another question is, why does a non-returner takes rebirth, but they say he usually takes rebirth in the formless realm?
No, I said the form realm.
Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Okay, so let us continue, since I want to finish the sutta today. Okay, so then the Buddha sort of just sums up by saying, these states are entirely wholesome and have a wholesome outcome. They are noble, supermundane, and inaccessible to the evil one. The evil one is Mara. Okay, now with section 19, there seems to be a change of topic here. Now the Buddha is going to speak about, this seems to be now reverting to the original topic with which the sutta opens, that is, keeping company with others, associating with others. So now the Buddha is going to explain why a disciple should seek the teacher's company even if he is dismissed, told to go away. And by the teacher here is referring to, this refers to the Buddha. So Ananda asked the Buddha to explain, and the Buddha's explanation seems a little puzzling initially. He says, a disciple should not seek the teacher's company for the sake of discourses, stanzas, and expositions. That is, in order to hear suttas, or to learn new verses, or to get explanations. And why is that? Now the Buddha is speaking specifically to Ananda. So he says, for a long time, Ananda, you have learned the teachings, remembered them, recited them, examined them with the mind, and penetrated them well by view. But such talk as deals with effacement, as leads to the mind's release, and which leads to complete disenchantment, dispassion, and so on to Nibbana, that is, then he mentions the 10 topics of talk, wanting little, contentment, seclusion, keeping aloof from society, energy, virtue, concentration, wisdom, liberation, knowledge, and vision of liberation. For the sake of such talk, a disciple should seek the teacher's company. Well, it seemed to me, this is why I find this a little puzzling, that when the Buddha speaks about all of these topics, what he's speaking, we would call suttas or discourses. So why does he say to Ananda, you shouldn't seek the teacher's company for the sake of discourses, standards, and explanations? Doesn't it seem contradictory? The Buddha is going to give, say, a discourse on wanting little. You'll hear it. Then you repeat it to others and it becomes a sutta. You know, the Buddha doesn't say, I'm going to teach you such and such a sutta. Then he starts speaking. But the Buddha just says, I'm going to speak on say, wanting little, or I'm going to speak on concentration, then he speaks, and those who listen preserve the material, and then they turn it into a sutta.
Monte, maybe it's you're not supposed to get caught up in the words, it's what you delve deeper into the meaning is what he's saying, or?
I think maybe that's the case, so. Especially because he's speaking to Ananda, and Ananda was what they call the treasurer of the Dhamma, the storekeeper of the Dhamma.
It's like repeating the sutras all the time, but you don't know the meaning.
But he says,
right,
it's not for the sake of, well, he's saying to Ananda that you, for a long time, you've examined them with the mind and penetrated them well by view. Stephen?
I was wondering, Bhante, if this would be some sort of critique of the more Vedic tradition of recitation?
Actually, that's a good idea. Could be.
Hi, Bhante.
Okay, Victor?
I mean, perhaps he was talking about a book of knowledge versus insight, maybe? Could that be?
Yeah, that's, I think, pretty much what the other two were saying. Except in those days, of course, they didn't have books. But it's just textual knowledge.
Yeah, textual or just memorization.
Yeah, probably so. Anyway, let us continue. Okay, now the Buddha introduces, again, this is sort of building up or continuing the line of seeking out company or associating with others closely and intimately in improper ways. So he's speaking about the undoing of a teacher, the undoing of a pupil, and the undoing of one who lives the holy life or the spiritual life in the Buddha's teaching. The word that's translated here as undoing, you see in Pali it's upadava, which actually it's a better translation would be something like the disaster or calamity. The calamity of the teacher. The calamity for a pupil. The calamity for one who leads the holy life. Like the word upadava, it's used to describe things like floods, wildfires, earthquakes, windstorms, destructive windstorms, like cyclones. Okay, so how does the teacher's calamity come about? Okay, here we have a teacher who resorts to a secluded resting place, forest, the root of a tree, and so on. Okay, while he is living thus in seclusion, Brahmins and householders from town and country visit him. So he becomes, you know, people start talking about him. Oh, there's this great guru who's living in the Himalayas in a secluded place, and he has maybe he's practiced these austerities, he stood on one leg for a long time, or he's fasted for weeks on end, and he's has long matted hair and just a loincloth and body covered with ashes, and maybe he's able to sit in samadhi for sometimes for a couple of weeks, and he has psychic powers. So people come to see him, and then as a result of constant exposure to people chatting, before long, he becomes filled with desire. He succumbs to craving and reverts to a life of luxury. Well, this happens, I have to say. I mean, even within, well, we'll come to the Buddhist order later. But this seems to be a typical pattern within, I know, with amongst the Hindu swamis, starting off living in with retreat, very austere conditions, they become famous, they get many lay disciples, then do you need a dwelling place, master? Oh yes, then in their enthusiasm they build a little palace for him. And then do you need some company at night? Oh yes, and then before long the palace is filling up with servants, attendants, and bring him sumptuous food. And then the sweet young girls start coming to visit him, awed by his austerities and rumors of psychic powers. Then he becomes attracted to the sweet young girls, and then before long there are scandals breaking out, and then his reputation gets ruined. That's happened so many times. If you remember, you were there back in those days, 1980s, they called him Bhagavan Rajneesh. Then he changed his name to Osho. Dina is from that generation.
I went to one meeting once.
Oh. Yeah, they used to, always used to see them walk, excuse me?
Nothing.
Used to see them walking around. They would always have to wear
orange.
Yeah, this color clothing.
Bright orange.
Yeah, sometimes it was bright, sometimes it was a duller, but it was some shade of this. And always a mala with a cameo photograph of Rajneesh inside the locket. And then he was kicked out of India, so he moved to the U.S.
Oregon,
and they bought up a whole town.
Rolls Royces.
Yeah, Rolls Royces, and his guards had machine guns or rifles.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. Okay, then he is struck down by evil, unwholesome states that defile, bring renewal of existence, ripen in suffering, lead to future birth, old age, and death. So that's how the teacher's calamity comes about. Okay, then how does the pupil's calamity come about? Okay, the pupil imitates his teacher, and then the same thing happens to the pupil. Okay, how does the calamity of one who lives the holy life, that is, who lives the spiritual life or brahmacharya under the Buddha, come about? Okay, here the Tathagata appears in the world, that's the Buddha. Okay, so the Buddha resorts to secluded dwelling places. Okay, then a disciple of the Buddha emulates his teacher's seclusion and resorts to a secluded dwelling place, the forest, and so on. And while he is living thus withdrawn, Brahmins and householders from town and country visit him. And this happens, it's not only the Hindu Swamis, but it also happens with Buddha's forest monks. I've heard about this in Thailand, like some of the monks from the Achan Mun tradition. Achan Mun was this very austere, the one who actually revived the forest meditative tradition in Thailand in the early and middle of the 20th century. So he was the teacher of many of the forest masters of the late 20th century, like Achan Mahabua. He was a part-time teacher of Achan Cha and some of the others, Achan Tate, Achan Lee, and so on. So many of these teachers start off living very austere lives, just deep in the forest with just a little bamboo hut they've built themselves or their lay followers have built for them. And then they start to attract disciples, more lay followers. And then as roads get built in Thailand coming into the northeast, the forest area, people from Bangkok, the wealthy people, come driving up in buses and cars to visit them. And they say, oh, we can't let our master live in just a little bamboo hut. We have to get a decent dwelling place for him. And so before long, they have a little palace built with, you know, everything. The master is saying, I don't want that. But please, master, help us get some merit. We are just simple lay people. We want to get some merits. Out of compassion, please accept our new cottage. They'll say, okay, I accept. And they'll build him maybe a three-story cottage with a dozen rooms. Okay, and usually I have to say that the forest Achans still maintain their austere way of life, but they get given too many gifts, too many offerings, much more than they need. And some do get spoiled. And then it does happen that some fall away. And so here the Buddha describes one who becomes filled with desire, succumbs to craving, reverts to luxury, and then he gets struck down by evil, unwholesome states, and so there comes to be the calamity of one who leads the holy life. And then the Buddha says that the calamity of one who leads the holy life has a more painful result, a more bitter result, than the teacher's calamity or the pupil's calamity that is outside the Buddha's teaching. And it even leads to perdition, that is to the lower realms of rebirth. But I have to say, to qualify this, that if somebody is leading the monastic life and they feel that they're overcome by temptation and they don't want to lead it anymore, if they admit their inability and honorably give up the monastic life and return to the lay life, they could still lead a good, wholesome life and even practice very diligently and even reach some of the noble attainments. But I think what the Buddha is speaking about is one who reaps a bitter result, is one who is overcome by the unwholesome states, by desire and craving, and then while still presenting themselves as a monastic, violates the fundamental precepts. And probably what he's speaking about, though the text doesn't mention this, is engaging in sexual relations undercover. Well, posing as a brahmachari, as one who's leading the celibate life, one is, in actual fact, not leading it. Okay, then the Buddha ends the sutta, again with some, I told you last week that the sutta sometimes has a stern tone to it. So the Buddha says to Ananda and to the other monks, behave towards me with friendliness, not with hostility. That will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. And how do disciples behave towards the teacher? With hostility, not with friendliness. That is when the teacher gives them advice compassionately and says, this will lead to your welfare and happiness. Do this, practice this. Then the disciples don't listen, don't try to understand, but they just follow their own desires. And so that's how they behave with hostility. And how do they behave towards the teacher with friendliness? That is when the Buddha gives them advice, saying, this is for your welfare and happiness, do this, practice this. Then they listen, they listen carefully, they try to understand, and they put the Buddha's advice into practice. Okay, then the Buddha ends the sutta with a simile, which is not immediately so clear to us because I don't think any of us has practiced making pots. Okay, the Buddha says, I shall not treat you the way a potter treats the raw, damp clay, but repeatedly restraining you, I shall speak to you, or I shall teach you, Ananda. Repeatedly admonishing you, I shall speak to you. The sound core will stand the test. To understand this, I had to rely on the commentary. I say what the commentary says is that when the potter is making a pot from clay, when he's forming the pot, he treats it very carefully, very gently, so that he gets the pot, you know, the clay perfectly formed to make the pot. Then he puts the clay, when he gets a number of pots formed, he puts them on a tray and then puts them into the oven and bakes the clay for the clay to turn hard. Then he takes the clay out, or he takes the pots out from the oven. Then he takes a stick and hits the pots. And if the pot is badly formed, so that it won't make a good usable pot, it'll break. But if the pot has been properly formed and will be useful, then when he hits it, it will stand up. And so the Buddha treats the pupils the way he treats the baked clay, not the raw clay. So he'll be repeatedly admonishing, repeatedly advising, instructing, restraining the disciples. And those who don't want to take the instructions, those who don't like to be admonished and exhorted, those will turn away and leave. But those who recognize that the Buddha's instructions are given with kindness and compassion, out of concern for the well-being of the disciple, they will remain and continue to practice till they become strong and steady. Any quick questions? We'll have a discussion. Okay, Barbara?
The Buddha himself was given lots of gifts, lots of land, lots of people around.
Yeah.
Yet he doesn't talk about the way he kept those from toppling him. Now, clearly it's because he was enlightened.
Yeah.
But is there more than that?
I'm trying
because
to think.
He allowed, there were people around him. He might go off now and then, but he was with the people.
Yeah, I think this could be the point that the Buddha is making earlier in the sutta. Let me just find the passage. Yeah, this would be on page 972. In paragraph 6, where the Buddha says that there is this abiding which has been discovered or awakened to by the Tathagata, that is how to enter and dwell in emptiness internally by giving no attention to all signs or to all objects. So while the Tathagata is dwelling in that way, he's visited by monks and nuns, by male and female lay followers, by kings and ministers, by other teachers and their disciples. Okay, and then with a mind leaning to seclusion, tending and inclining to seclusion, delighting in renunciation, with a mind that's altogether done away with concern for things that are the basis for the taints, for the defilements, then he talks to them in a way concerned with dismissing them. Now, so the Buddha has this inner abiding in emptiness to which he can repeatedly return and which he, that's where he takes his delight. And so when he speaks to others, he does so. But because he's, as you put it, he's already gained enlightenment, and he's done away with all of these things that are the basis for the defilements. And so for that reason, the Buddha doesn't get caught up in these, all of the gifts that he receives. Okay, I think we'll have to end now, and then we'll come back at 12:30, and then we could have some discussion about anything in the sutta, the earlier part as well as this part. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. Do we have the sheets? Okay, we just do the recitation. I'll just do the recitation. To share the merits with the devas, the buddhas, the fair spirits, wishing them to protect the world, to protect the teaching, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Sasanam. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Desanam. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Mang Param. Etavatacha Mehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Devanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya. The short way. Sabbe Bhutanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Sabbe Satanumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya. Bhavagupadaya avichihetato etantare satakayupapana rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhuting. Okay, we'll end with three half bows to the Buddha.